Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of my 40 or so years in government and out monitoring what it's doing, there are a few people that I have come to admire more than our first guest today. He is Congressman Chris Stewart. He represents with great distinction the people of the 2nd District of Utah in the United States House of Representatives. He has a long and distinguished background of service to our country, notably in the United States Air Force, where he was a command pilot of a B-1 aircraft. Not only that, set the world record for round-the-world high-speed circumnavigation. He's written numerous best-selling books on various subjects, fiction and nonfiction. He is an extraordinary Renaissance man and a great guest, member of the House Appropriations Committee, and also the now quite controversial House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, about which we wish to speak. Congressman, it's great to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us.
No, it's good to be with you. You're always too kind, but you're such a good friend. Thank you.
Well, it's all heartfelt and deserved, in fact. So let's start with the HPSI, as it's known. You have been in the midst of the back and forth over this series of memos. Tell us what's going on, Congressman, and where we really ought to be focusing our attention, if it's not on the content of these memos or the collusion scandal that they in various ways address.
Yeah, you know, you ask what's going on, and the answer to that is we're trying to tell the American people the truth, and it's a truth that matters. It's a truth that they absolutely need to know, and some people don't want us to do that. Here's what it is in 30 seconds. For the last year and 3 months, we've heard collusion, conspiracy, which is, by the way, treason, between Donald Trump and his associates in Russia, except for there's virtually no evidence of that. And that's just not me saying that. That's General Clapper. It's Dianne Feinstein. It's most reasonable Democrats. No evidence of it. Now, the second story is this. Hillary Clinton and the DNC hired Fusion GPS, who ironically hired a foreign agent who almost certainly worked with Russian agents to create the dossier that we know as political garbage. And then the most troubling is the FBI and Department of Justice, and whether they were truthful with the FISA courts, whether they tried to hide information from the FISA courts, and whether they spied on an American citizen who had no accusations against him except for he was an associate of Trump. I think that's a big deal, and it's something that people need to know about.
And I commend you for the work that you're doing to try to dig into all of that. The politicization of the FBI and the Department of Justice, the weaponization, if you will, in sort of the context of political warfare, is profoundly corrosive to our freedoms and to our republic. And it's incredibly alarming that it's not getting more attention. And when it is getting attention, it's almost entirely dismissed as just you guys trying to deflect attention from the real scandal, which involves Donald Trump. Could you speak to that, Congressman Stewart?
Well, the real scandal, which, as I said, there's no evidence of. I can't imagine, and I mean this sincerely, I cannot imagine why people protect this type of behavior. Why in the world would the media or would any Democrat or any individual say, yeah, it's okay for the FBI to authorize spying on U.S. citizens and not be honest about it? It's okay for Department of Justice to be dishonest with the committee and to have under force of subpoena to come and answer these questions. It's okay for, like you said, for the weaponization of these agencies who essentially become an extension of any political party. How could anyone say, you know, that's not a story, that's not a big deal? And I promise if President Trump did this, I would condemn him as well. If we don't contain this and root it out, we become nothing but a third world banana republic.
Yeah. And Congressman Stewart, you know, you say that you would condemn it. You can bet that this would be the subject of 24-hour nonstop coverage in every press outlet in America and a lot beyond. if Donald Trump were implicated in something in any way, shape, or form like this kind of political abuse.
No question about that. Yeah, and, you know, one other thing that's worth noting, one of the criticisms of the Republicans for this effort is they say, well, you're attacking the FBI, you're attacking Department of Justice. Look, two thoughts on that. Number one, as you mentioned, I was an Air Force pilot, a military officer. If we had tremendous responsibilities, but with that came tremendous power and authority, you have to hold those people in account. And I don't remember anyone during Abu Ghraib, for example, where some military members did things they shouldn't have done, saying, oh, wait, no, you can't attack the military. Well, you can hold them accountable. We want to be held accountable. I've had FBI agents say, thank you for bringing this to light. This doesn't represent us. This isn't the type of work that we do. And we're not condemning the entire FBI. We're not condemning the entire Department of Justice. We're just condemning the activities of some of their leaders. We know that most of these guys are good public servants that we want to support. And it's a very important distinction to make.
Let me turn to, speaking of politics, Congressman, well, spectacle, I think, is a fair term for it, of your counterpart committee in the Senate yesterday had a rather impressive display of administration witnesses representing most, if not virtually all, of the major intelligence agencies of this country. You, of course, spend a lot of time with those folks, but this is one of the rare occasions when the public gets to see them. And I just would be interested in your thoughts both about the content of the hearing, what was said in it, and as importantly, Congressman, what wasn't addressed in its course?
Well, to be fair, I didn't get to see all of the hearing. I've seen parts of it, but I've read of it. And I think the most important thing that was heard, and this may surprise people, but I think in many cases, we underestimate the importance of the rise of China. And it's seeking influence, not only in its own sphere, but frankly, globally. And they're so good at it. They're meticulous. They're patient. They're funding it. They have a plan. By the 100th anniversary of the creation of the Communist Party in China in 2048, they expect to have reached these milestones, and they're reaching those milestones along the way. And we just can't turn a blind eye to China and not recognize that we have a real challenge in managing the relationships of these two powers, because they seek to become not only a co-equal superpower, they actually seek to be the superpower on a global scale. And there's two things, and Russia does the same thing. You know, we think of being in conflict with these nations, and we think of tanks and airplanes and soldiers killing each other. Their idea of conflict is very different. It encompasses a much greater scale. It encompasses, obviously, cyber. It encompasses psychological. It encompasses intelligence, where you've got Chinese agents infiltrating our universities and our think tanks and working in the commerce and in the defense. Look, there's all sorts of things that they've been able to embed themselves with.
And, you know, what's so interesting about that, Congressman, is we actually know the blueprint of what they're doing. It specifically was laid out in 1999 by two, colonels in the Chinese People's Liberation Army. It was entitled Unrestricted Warfare, and it goes into considerable detail on how the Chinese will advance that long-term strategy that you spoke of. One other thing that I was sort of struck by was the lack of attention to the jihadist problem in the course of the hearing. The term radical Islamic terrorism, as best I can tell, did not appear anywhere, a term the president once used as, you know, the way he was going to describe the problem. Just very quickly, Congressman, we're almost out of time. Your thoughts on the importance of attending more carefully to that problem as well, the civilization jihad as well as the violent kind.
Yeah, and I knew you would bring that up, and I'm grateful that you do, because, as I said, you are a leading voice on this. You are, in some ways, a crying voice in the wilderness, because you're calling attention to something that is too often ignored or minimized. And you know what? I try to balance these. In one sense, I wonder if we haven't strained at a gnat and swallowed a camel, in the sense that for the last 15 years, we focused only on the global war on terror, the distraction of some of these other challenges. But at the same time, it is an enormous challenge for us. It is an enormous threat to us. And I worry sometimes that the American people are so weary of that, that they're not going to give it the attention and the focus that it deserves as well. People like you reminding us is important.
Being weary is no excuse for paying attention to a challenge that is really at our throats, I'm afraid. Congressman, thank you for the chance to interact with you. As always, it's an informative and illuminating one, and I appreciate so much the work you're doing on Capitol Hill. I hope you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West about some of this, the anniversary of Dresden, and the red thread in this saga of Russia today. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, one of the most interesting people I know, a woman who has contributed mightily over many years through her outstanding columns and now her blogs at dianawest.net to the public policy debate. You can also find her writings from time to time, places like the Daily Caller. And of course, we welcome her here to visit about things that she's touched on, particularly in her two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. And seems to be a lot of that going on at the moment, Diana West, and I'm anxious to catch up with you about it. But right out of the pages of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, is the historical experience of World War II. And you describe in particular the role that Soviet influence operations played in protracting that war. And you've noted in your blog at dianawest.net a particular anniversary of same that we take note of right about now. Talk about Dresden and how this fits into that larger theme.
We are right this week experiencing the 73rd anniversary of the firebombing of Dresden, which killed something around the size of 25,000 civilians in a three-day campaign of firebombing, Allied firebombing. And this has always been presented to us as a terrible, atrocious, barbarous necessity to bring about the fall of Nazi Germany. What I discovered in writing American Betrayal, however, was very significant discussion and evidence, for example, by historian John Keegan, that this act was actually taken at the behest of Stalin in order to clear a path for the Red Army to more easily advance on Berlin and points west. This becomes just a signal moment of betrayal of all manner of things, including America, but certainly the people of Dresden and Europe, in the larger scheme of Soviet influence operations that prolonged the war, that turned the Allied armies essentially into allies of Stalin's territorial gains across Europe and Asia.
The theory being that the Nazis were prepared to capitulate to the West before all of this happened. So, Diana, you're saying that the Germans would have surrendered to us, but for the fact that we kept going at Stalin's behest, if I got that about right?
Well, there were many number of efforts by Germans to surrender to British and Americans. This is it's a complicated story, but the point is that there were many, many, many Soviet agents of influence in place inside all the war councils, Allied and enemy alike, and their war could end too soon, meaning that if Stalin were still inside the USSR boundaries, it would have been a complete disaster, even if millions and millions of people had been lived. The point was to keep the war going long enough so that Stalin could make these territorial gains in both Europe and Asia that we see, in fact, take place and change the world forever.
And created the horrors of the oppression by the Soviets of most of Central and Eastern Europe, and of course the Cold War and all that went along with that. Diana, fascinating background to our own time. Talk, if you would, about the rather remarkable series that you have been writing at your web blog, dianawest.net. You entitle it The Red Thread. You're up to the eighth installment of this, and you've been stitching together insights that sound as though there's still very much a successful Russian influence operation underway that was perhaps at the core of what went down in the campaign against Donald Trump during the election of 2016 and subsequently. Flesh this out for us a little bit.
Yes. Well, it's a lengthy series. It includes a lot of detail because what I find to be the most salient characteristic of our reporting today is a complete lack of context, a complete failure to probe whether there are ideological drivers here, socialism, communism. We call them, when we do speak about them, Alinskyism, progressivism, things like that. But I'm trying to go back to the font, which is, of course, Marxism-Leninism, and find out if we are looking at people who follow in these traditions inside this vast, increasingly vast, conspiracy within the Obama administration and the federal government to subvert the Trump campaign and presidency. And I am finding quite a lot of what I'm calling red threads in terms of connections, in terms of continuity, in terms of presence at the creation. It's really quite a fascinating exercise that I do hope to pursue and also make a little more manageable in terms of collapsing it so that it is more easily digestible. But this has to be done because we have essentially wiped the slate clean of all of these understandings and our own recognition of the very clear tells that we may see. I mean, I think it is extremely significant that Christopher Steele, the very famous dossier creator, was known as a confirmed socialist when he was at Cambridge in the mid-1980s. This comes from actually a book about the Cambridge Debating Society by a man who is currently Theresa May's, an advisor of Theresa May's, an anonymous kind of sourcing. This is something, a history of the Cambridge Debating Society. I think it is very significant that when we examine the academic output of Nellie Orr, who is the mystery woman who worked for GPS Fusion and whose husband used to be number four man at the Justice Department, we find what they called a revisionist historian, which when you actually examine what these people are all about on our campuses that came up in the 70s and 80s, out of the New Left, out of the Marxist groups on campuses, you find an apologist for Stalin. I mean, this is a true story when you go back to her work on 1930s USSR. Aren't these ideological flags something we should be looking at to understand the context in which this extreme, these felonious behaviors that we are seeing exposed were undertaken in this extremely unusual election cycle? In other words, these people were not just going out of power as Democrats and Republicans do every 4 to 8 years. They were taking ultimate risks of their careers, their pensions, their liberty itself, if these things seem to be going where they're going. And you have to understand, was there something special driving them? And I think there is, and this is what the Red Thread series is all about.
And, you know, Dinah, we're listening to a lot of fulminating, as we talked about with Congressman Chris Stewart a moment ago, about the Russian influence operations and their interference in our elections and so on. But as you say, it's not grounded in the motivations, which may well be shared by people who, as our friend Trevor Loudon has documented, actually are not only in our government's executive branch, but certainly in the United States Congress. These are extraordinarily important, as you say, tells of a much larger problem. I consider this sort of all in the general domain of counterintelligence, a truly lost art at the moment. And the work you've been doing, particularly in connection with American Betrayal and your analyses that have flowed from it, is simply incalculably important. And I want to commend you for it and thank you for taking the time to discuss it a little bit with us. Today, we'll look forward to part 9, I imagine, or maybe 9 and 10 by the time we get to you next week. But keep up the great work, my dear. Check it out, folks, at dianawest.net. an extraordinary resource for matters that all of us should be paying attention to. We'll talk with you again very soon, Dinah. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Spencer about the jihadists in our midst and other threats to Americans' freedom. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined by the indispensable director of Jihad Watch, the author of some 15 books, including several New York Times bestsellers, notable among them, The Truth About Mohammed and the Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. I'm also appreciative that he's a man who has been contributing mightily to some of the products of the Center for Security Policies, particularly in the video space. He is, of course, Robert Spencer. You must check out his work at Jihad Watch, but also his columns at PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. And, of course, monitor this program closely, because whenever we have him, it's always magic. Thank you so much, Robert. Great to have you, sir.
Always great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, I wanted very quickly to get your sort of impressions of what is happening in Europe. You do a marvelous job of documenting this at Jihad Watch, but just give us a sense of what we're seeing in Sweden, in the UK, and what it means not only for what's happening to our friends and allies over there, but potentially to us.
It's really quite astonishing how quickly this is all happening, Frank. For one thing, just today, a leading researcher at the Swedish Defense College has declared that he has found that Sweden is now a hub for Islamic Jihad plotting in Europe. And it's not that these people are coming in plotting elsewhere, but they are using Sweden now as a base. The situation has advanced to that degree. In the UK, it's something similar, because we have the mayor of London saying that he does not have the finances, does not have the resources any longer to pursue all kinds of crimes, including to pursue the jihad terrorists the way that the public would want him to. Meanwhile, there has been an exponential increase of arrests for so-called hate speech in Britain. And what the British are devoting their resources to increasingly is not to cracking down on jihad terrorists, but cracking down on the so-called extreme right, the people who are trying to say that there is a problem here with jihad terrorists.
I saw a video the other day of Katie Hopkins addressing, I think, an audience in the United States, warning of what's happening. She being one of those being targeted for this kind of, Sharia blasphemy restrictions on saying anything that might be deemed offensive to Islam or Muslims. She is arguing, and I think you and I would agree with her, Robert, that we mustn't let the United States go the way of Great Britain. And I wanted to ask you next about what you're seeing, Robert, and reporting on at Jihad Watch concerning the influence operations, the penetration. We talked a moment ago with Dinah West about some of this in connection with Russia, but what I think of them as Sharia supremacists are up to under banners like that of the Council on American-Islamic Relations to penetrate and suborn and otherwise influence our political elite.
Well, you know, when you say that we don't want to go down the path that Britain is going, unfortunately, all too many American politicians are doing so. And one of the things that the Council on American-Islamic Relations has been magnificently successful in doing is normalizing itself, despite Justice Department evidence that it is connected to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that it has opposed every counterterror measure that has ever been proposed or implemented anywhere, despite the fact that all over the country, its pamphlets that it distributes at its conferences tell Muslims not to cooperate with the FBI, not to aid in law enforcement efforts against terrorism. Despite all that, it's still considered a respectable civil rights organization. And recently we had Congressman Mike Quigley speak at its Chicago banquet, which was called a resistance banquet. Resisting what was a little bit unclear, but the fact that it's normalized is very clear, that the Democratic Party politicians all over the country think that it's not only a responsibility, but an honor to be associated with this Hamas-linked Muslim Brotherhood front group. That is an astonishing turn of events, and one that's quite ominous for public policy and for counterterror efforts.
It is indeed. Speaking of its links to Hamas, we have a book called Care is Hamas, as I think you know, which just simply pulls out some of that evidence from the Holy Land Foundation trial, in which it's clear from the FBI surveillance back in the day when they did this sort of thing of the Hamas and other Sharia supremacists who met in 1993 to found the Council on American Islamic Relations, that this was a direct product of Hamas and its efforts to have a political warfare instrument and fundraising mechanism. So this is very ominous indeed. And I think what we're going to see much more of, especially with a Muslim Brotherhood tied individual as the number two man in the Democratic National Committee, namely Representative Keith Ellison, is a lot more of this bonding between the red, as they say, and the green in the left and the Islamist ranks of the Democratic Party.
It's amazing, really, when you consider that it was just revealed that Ellison met in a clandestine meeting with the president of Iran, an extraordinarily repressive, bloodthirsty regime, and Louis Farrakhan, whose wildly anti-Semitic statements have been abundantly documented, and nobody cares. There's no repercussions for Ellison whatsoever as the number two man in the Democratic National Committee. And yet, imagine if he had met with the Klan or something like that, the press would be all over it. But there's a tremendous double standard when it comes to connections to jihad leaders, to Islamic anti-Semites, and so on.
Well, and again, and your work is incalculable importance in documenting all of this at jihadwatch.org. I hope that our audience has bookmarked your products. And I was listening to Breitbart this morning talking about efforts being made to suppress their platform at Google, I think was the specific case in point. It's happening, I know, to them and others of us, including your good self, on several of these social media outlets. So it's all the more important that we be making proactively the effort to monitor what you're doing and acting upon it, Robert Spencer. Let me ask you, speaking of acting, this is, of course, not only Valentine's Day, named for Saint Valentine's, a man who, Saint Valentine, I should say, a man who was martyred for his faith. The Romans, as I recall, stoned him, but did not kill him and wound up having to behead him in the end. That's not exactly what we associate with Valentine's Day these days, of course, but it's also Ash Wednesday. And Robert, I wanted to call to your attention and that of our audience the fact that there is a new coalition, I'm very proud to be part of it, called the Save the Persecuted Christians Coalition. And I know you follow closely what's happening to Christians, particularly in the Middle East, but this is truly a universal problem. And I'd like to get your thoughts on the importance of rallying the American people on behalf of Christians who are being subjected in truly staggering numbers to persecution. Open Doors has estimated that 215 million Christians around the world are facing now heavy persecution or worse. Your thoughts, sir?
And this is why this coalition is so important. People don't know that Christians are the most persecuted group in the world today, and that ancient Christian communities that go back to the time of Christ in the Middle East have been decimated, destroyed. Some will never recover. And these things have been done under the aegis of the Islamic Jihad imperative that the Western media continues to whitewash and ignore. And this is why there is no attention given to the plight of these people, and why it's so important that American Christians and all people of goodwill who deplore this kind of persecution be alerted to what's happening. And so I applaud this effort. And Frank, if there's anything I can possibly do for it, I am very happy to help.
I know that you will, and it's needed, Robert, as it is for all of us. I hope folks will check this out. The website is savethepersecutedchristians.org. And just to add to your point, Robert, unfortunately, according to Open Doors USA's World Watch report, North Korea is the most repressive of all of the countries in the world when it comes to Christians. And unfortunately, the communist Chinese and Hindu nationalists in India and others are, I guess, competing with the Islamic States and the other jihadists of the world for the opportunity to repress these people. We need to stand with them, and we look forward to doing that together with others who are concerned about this and working hard on it at SaveThePersecutedChristians.org. Robert Spencer, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us again very soon, my friend. It's so good to talk with you. Next up, Suzanne Schulte will join us. We'll talk about North Korea, the threat that it poses to all of us, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by a woman that I've come to admire enormously over many years for her indefatigable efforts on behalf of freedom, most especially, but not singularly, in North Korea, a country that is, I think, increasingly obvious, a great and growing danger, of course, to its own people, but to its neighbors, and now increasingly to us. I'm speaking, of course, of Suzanne Schulte. She is the chairman of the North Korea Freedom Coalition and the president of the Defense Forum Foundation. She has been an extraordinary resource for us, and it's always a delight to have her back. Welcome, Suzanne Schulte. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Well, I mentioned in my conversation with Robert Spencer a moment ago that the country you track so closely and do so much to expose, North Korea, is the very worst in the world, according to Open Doors, when it comes to persecution of Christians. Of course, it's pretty hard on everybody else subject to its misrule as well. There was a moment that I think was just unforgettable in the President's State of the Union address recently that showcased some of that in the person of a defector. I just wanted to say to you and to everyone who admires you as I do, I consider the work that you do sort of now personified by the scene of those crutches being waved from the gallery to the standing ovation of the entire chamber. Talk a little bit about that and the insights that it gives us, the man's story in particular, about just how horrible this North Korean regime is.
I thought that what President Trump did was just terrific. And in addition to making the issue of the human rights situation in North Korea, to giving it that human face, that to show the face of the suffering with Ji Sung-ho was just wonderful. And it meant so much to those of us in the North Korea human rights movement, but also to the defectors, because it dramatized very strongly what's happening to people in that country. I also think the speech he gave in South Korea was the best speech I've ever heard by any president about North Korea, because we have got to keep the focus on the human rights in North Korea. Otherwise, we feed into the propaganda of the regime. And I think that you talk about religious persecution. In North Korea, it is the number one country for the persecution of Christians, because they set up their own false religion, and it's a propaganda and a brainwashing. And we got to see the face of one of the number one brainwashers, the sister at the Olympics.
Talk a bit about her, and in particular, Suzanne, this fatuous embrace of her, not just sadly by the South Korean government, but by the press in the West. I've got a couple of exemplary headlines from the various media outlets. CNN calling Kim Jong-un's sister the person stealing the show at the Winter Olympics, and Yahoo, North Korea's political princess, and the BBC, the sister with a sweet but tomboy streak. I mean, please, what's going on here?
What the North Koreans achieved with the Olympics was brilliant, and this is one of the things I think that we fail to realize. The North Koreans are brilliant at deception and manipulation, and they really achieved so much through these Olympics. It is appalling to me that the way that she was cited and greeted in the headlines, because it just completely ignored her role in being part of this murderous regime, which has been described by the UN Commission of Inquiry as having no parallel in the level of human rights violations that are occurring. I think we look at North Korea and we don't realize how capable they are at manipulating things. And certainly with South Korea, what the Moon administration did, they got nothing for all the concessions and all the things that they did to get North Korea to participate, to be there. It's appalling to me. South Korea should have been celebrating their incredible, remarkable economic achievements, their republic, but they banned their own flag. They banned their own national anthem. And it was all to appease North Korea, and they got nothing for it.
Well, I gather they've gotten a summit meeting invitation to come to North Korea, at which presumably President Moon of South Korea will simply offer more concessions. And how is this playing both in South Korea as you see it? Again, there are reports that this North Korean princess charmed the people of the South, but particularly among the community of people that you work with so closely, Suzanne Schulte, namely the folks who have, in some cases, risked everything to get to freedom from North Korea.
Well, as soon as the Moon administration announced that they were banning any criticism of the Kim regime during the Olympics and before the Olympics, the people I work with started ripping up pictures of Kim Jong-un and recording doing that and then posting it on YouTube. They were so appalled at the stifling of free speech of the people of South Korea. And I'm very concerned about the direction that South Korea is going and how much this may impact the human rights movement. Because we have gotten to the point now where it is indisputable that crimes against humanity are occurring in North Korea. And as you know, Frank, for years we've talked about these political prison camps, but people didn't really believe it. It's taken 30,000 people escaping for the world to finally acknowledge that, yes, these things are happening.
But even then, they're trying to overlook it or put a gloss on it. And again, as you know so well, Suzanne, this is only part of what's going seriously wrong in North Korea at the moment, and that is, in addition, the combination of longer and longer range ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons on top. So the point that we've often discussed, that any country that treats their own people that badly is unlikely to treat ours better, mustn't be lost on us. Hey, you are doing one other thing that I wanted to commend you for and call attention to. Talk a bit about what you're trying to do to get the message into North Korea about how people in this country feel about their cause and the need for them to be freed from this tyranny.
Well, we do a program twice a year, for the new year, which is coming up. The Korean New Year is starting on Friday, which they call Solal, the Korean New Year. We broadcast messages from American leaders into North Korea. It's a partnership we have with Free North Korea Radio, which is a defector radio station based in Seoul. And basically, we go to members of Congress and we say, what would you like to tell the people of North Korea? And they basically, these messages are consistent about sharing our hopes and dreams, just emphasizing the fact that we care deeply for the people of North Korea, but we want to see the end of the dictatorship. And just articulating what is so important, we've got to focus on the fact that what we want for North Korea is to have the same freedoms and human rights that South Koreans and Americans enjoy, and to have that same friendship with South Korea that propelled them into the incredible economic powerhouse they are today. We need to emphasize that our problem, in other words, is with Kim Jong-un, because it's literally a place that where people are isolated and brainwashed, and his sister is key in that department of propagation agitation that works on glorifying this regime and demonizing the United States. And so that's why this program is so important, because it's really the heartfelt messages from members of Congress. And we have Democrats and Republicans participating in it, and we're real excited to be launching the New Year's messages for 2018 on Friday.
Tell us how people can find out more about the work you do with the North Korea Freedom Coalition and support that work.
Okay, well, for Free North Korea Radio, our website for the Defense Forum Foundation is defenseforumfoundation.org. The North Korea Freedom Coalition, we invite anybody who wants to join our coalition, we'd love to have you. That's nkfreedom.org.
Suzanne, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for what you do. You are an exemplar, as I say, of the commitment to freedom that I think all of us should aspire to, and your leadership is really appreciated. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.